Today we welcome Reverend Bob Tucker. Bob has served the First Congregational Church in Houston over nearly 30 years as the senior minister. He was also the executive director for the Foundation of Contemporary Theology for many years. He and Maggie, his wife, have visited us regularly for several years, and we have learned much from Bob's services. His program, I will turn it over to Reverend Bob Tucker.
Bob, you're still muted. You're still muted, Bob.
Now, yeah. Is that good?
That's good.
Okay. I was just saying how what a happy discovery Zoom has been to this group and to other groups in terms of keeping us connected with each other and having some sense of commonality. It was a great discovery at this time. Well, I titled today's talk, A Sibling Rivalry. And today I want to play with your minds. Actually, I'd like to rip out of your minds, demolish the pernicious idea that there is a war between religion and science. Now, if you don't believe that, you can just sit back and relax. The idea has been repeated so often without any strong contrary view that it seems almost to be a revealed truth. Or if absent that religious idea, at least it has achieved the status of an unmutable truth. The war between science and religion unthinkingly resides in people's minds, and it easily slips through lips when thinking and talking about the relationship of religion and science. And I'm going to make 5 points in this talk undermining this idea. And then there will be some discussion at the end, and you'll be able to tell me whether or not I've convinced you or not to dispose of this idea of a war between science and religion. Well, replacing the war metaphor is the first step. And I substitute a metaphor relating to the family. The difference between science and religion I refer to as a sibling rivalry. Think of two children belonging to the same family with the same genes, eating the same food around the table, hearing the same ethical rules, sleeping in the same bed, but at times kicking each other under the dinner table. Not a war, a sibling rivalry. And so rather than emphasizing the minor differences that lead to the kicking, I will list a few major family similarities. The first one is that both religion and science have a strong commitment to healing. When an employed minister, I was a regular weekly visitor to patients at the Houston Medical Center, described as the largest in the world. I have no reason to dispute that claim, trying to find one's way around that complex. The daily worker population of the medical center is around 106,000. Which is, as at least I looked up on the web, more than double the population of Galveston. There are 180 surgeries performed annually on average, only a few less than 500 per day. And the medical center contains 54 medically related institutions, 21 hospitals, and 8 specialty institutions, 8 academic and research institutions, 4 medical schools, 7 nursing schools, 3 public health organizations, 2 pharmacy schools, and 1 dental school. All 54 institutions are not-for-profit, and they all are required to do one or more of 3 things: to heal, to teach, to do research. Of the 21 hospitals, however, there are 5 which are prominent both by their size and their placement. And each of the 5 plays a role in the following story.
Once upon a time, before this pandemic, at a downtown Houston hotel, there was a banquet honoring the 4 horsemen, the leading American and English atheists of the day: Christopher Hitchens, Richard Dawkins, Sam Harris, and Daniel Dennett. Unfortunately, during his talk, Christopher Hitchens experiences heart palpitations. An ambulance was called. And as an act of solidarity, the other 3 honorees joined Hitchens in the back of the ambulance. The ambulance went immediately to Houston's downtown hospital, St. Joseph's. But seeing the name, the 4, all atheists, shook their heads vigorously. No, deciding not to use a Roman Catholic hospital. So the ambulance now races to the medical center. The first hospital they come to on Main Street is Memorial Hermann. Oops, with a Baptist background, the hospital has to be rejected. 20 seconds later, they are outside Methodist Hospital. Rousing himself from the pain, Hitchens again firmly shaking his head, no. Driving another 20 seconds, they arrive at St. Luke's Hospital, Episcopalian. Obviously, that too is unacceptable to the 4 atheists. Turning on Holcomb, in less than a minute, the ambulance races towards the Mammoth MD Anderson, a state cancer hospital. However, the entrance to the hospital is through the Lutheran Pavilion. To go into the non-religiously run hospital, but through a religiously named entrance, totally unacceptable. With 1 option remaining, they decide to ride 3 more minutes around the loop to the county hospital, Ben Taub, with its superb emergency care. Ben Taub is a hospital of a gift of a private individual given by a Reformed Jew, but is the only one of the 5 major, the 4 horsemen have found their hospital, but still suspiciously cautiously, even at Ben Taub, they inquire into the training of the attending physician to make certain she has not graduated from the oldest medical school in the center, Baylor, which is Methodist. Quickly checked by a graduate of a non-religiously affiliated medical school serving in a non-religiously founded hospital, Hutchinson's is cleared, discharged, and the 4 cohorts are pleased to leave, singing whatever the secular equivalent is of the doxology.
What I have tried to show in the once upon a time story of the 4 horsemen is that there is a strong link between religion and science in the healing art of medicine. Succinctly, religion builds, science inhabits. Well, the second similarity of church and science is the similarity in their mutual commitment to education. Now I'm turning to higher education. Again, religion builds and science inhabits, not with medical personnel, but with professors of a rationalistic scientific bent. The commitment of the original Puritans to education just stuns me at times. They landed in Boston in 1630, and only 6 years after landing, 6 years of clearing the land, planting crops, building their meeting house and homes, setting up government and courts, and in that 6th year, founding Harvard College. 1636. It was chartered, quote, to to provide a learned ministry when our present ministers lie in the dust. End of quote. Well, I just think it's incredible that these folks, in the midst of just surviving in this wilderness, were thinking about and then building a college. And prior to our country's war for independence in 1776, there were 9 colonial colleges. 8 were founded by religious groups: Harvard, William and Mary, Yale. And then Pennsylvania in 1740 was the one oddity. It was done by general subscription. But then Princeton, Columbia, Brown, Rutgers, Dartmouth. Although started by religious groups, by the American Revolution, all had open enrollment to any religion or non-religion. Then in 1862, in the midst of this country's Civil War, Senator James Morrell, a New Englander of the Congregational Pilgrim and Puritan Harvard and Yale tradition, wrote a law giving land to each state to develop what we today call land-grant universities. And eventually, there are about 70 of them around our country. And including in those 70 are the universities of Michigan and Minnesota, University of Hawaii, Texas A&M, and MIT. And so we have here two of the great institutions in our society, medicine and education, were for the first 3 centuries primarily founded by religious groups and then populated by rationalists of a more scientific bent. What war between religion and science? Well, there's a third similarity of religion and science, one that's incredibly violent. Everyone who has a bone to pick with religion makes violent episodes a triumphal point of debate. Well, they have 2,000 years of Christianity from which to select. Out of that history, a common litany rolls out: the Crusades, the 30 Years' War, the Inquisition, the Salem Trials. Indeed, having formally studied religious history in graduate school, I could make a list of violence that is far more extensive and gruesome than the abbreviated list of those who usually disparage religion. However, it needs to be noted that science itself emulates religion and violence. It is science that developed the disinfectant and insecticide Zyklon B, later used by the Nazis in the crematoriums. It is science that developed the atomic bomb, wiping out the cities of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And the estimates of killed in Hiroshima, 150,000, and Nagasaki, 75,000. But we still do not know the full list. It is science that developed the weapons that provided Donald Rumsfeld's shock and awe over Baghdad. It is science whose efforts have led to the plant, animal, and environmental degradation, toxification that so concerns us today. It was science and religion combined in 9/11 that brought down the Twin Towers. It was science that carried out the syphilis experiment at Tuskegee, begun in 1932. A time when there was no known treatment for syphilis. And so our government talked 600 impoverished African-American men to be enrolled in this project for 40 years to study the bodily degeneration caused by syphilis. And they were promised free medical care. In the middle of the study, penicillin was discovered to be an effective cure. However, and incredibly, it was never used to cure those individuals. They were left to slowly die so that the scientists could study the disease. Then a similar evil was perpetuated on Guatemalan citizens. In the mid to late 1940s, American doctors deliberately infected almost 700 prisoners, soldiers, mental patients with syphilis to trace the progress of the disease. In fact, recently, during the Obama administration, the United States apologized to Guatemala for those outrageous and abhorrent experiments carried out in the name of science. Actually, more people have died because of science, but only because science has given us more effective way of killing. And today there are larger concentrations of populations to kill. My point is that religion and science are these siblings, and they have, in addition to the benefits to humanity, which are great, have also been very violent and bloody at times. Well, the fourth similarity has come up more recently, and both experience the decline of trust. Dr. Joan Duvey was nominated by the governor of Ohio a month ago on the 10th of September for the job of state health director. Her delight turned to rapid resignation, not weeks, not days, just hours later when she withdrew her name for consideration. Why? She had talked with Dr. Amy Acton, her predecessor, and learned that she had resigned after armed protesters had been at Dr. Acton's home. Sounds absurd? Not really, after we become aware of the attempt to kidnap the sitting governor of Michigan. Well, then news came along with that same resignation from the Associated Press and the Kaiser Health that there have been at least 60 state or local health leaders in 27 states who have resigned, retired, or been fired since April, just 4 months. Dr. Fauci was right when he said in August that there is a fundamental anti-science feeling in the country today. A fundamental anti-science feeling in the country today. And science has joined religion now in facing public suspicion and censure. Certainly it was beyond my imagination a year ago that face masks and social distancing would be an arena of political controversy. Nor could I have imagined that armed citizens would be threatening the state director of health services in Ohio and a governor in Michigan. Nor could I have imagined the strained relationship between the president of this country and the government's Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. In my own mind, I was placing all the blame for the current situation directly on our president and his handling of the coronavirus. Then I read a statement by the editors of Scientific American, who for the first time in its 175th year history has backed a presidential candidate, Joe Biden. And if you'd like to read over their rationale for that, you can go to the internet and you find it there. So if President Trump distrusts the scientific community, the scientific community reciprocates that lack of trust. But as I looked into this matter of trust, I found that there is more than just the mutual antipathy of the scientific community in the present. It's been frequently noted that one reason for the election of Donald Trump in 2016 was that he touched a nerve of disdain many in our society have with experts running our government and our country, experts whose advice and policies have in the minds of citizens devastated the communities of Middle America. It was at a 2016 rally that Donald Trump spoke for the first time of draining the swamp, a metaphor that he did not coin, but one that he used very effectively. And that day he was announcing his plans for a sweeping ethics reform and pledging to make our government honest once again. Well, I shrugged my shoulders. This was just more election rhetoric. And parenthetically, I think he's created his own swamp. All that passed over my head since I am part of two professional elites in this country and have personally benefited from professional elites. But the broad-based general distrust in this country's elites became more understandable for me in a recent issue of the Christian Century, a weekly magazine that serves the liberal Christian community. There was a bar chart produced by polling of the Pew Trust that shows the low level of trust of Americans and our leaders, quote, to act in the best interest of the public, end of quote. At the bottom of the list was a great deal of trust level for elected officials at 3%. It rose to 17% for religious leaders. And the two trustworthy groups at the very top were medical scientists at 43% and scientists at general at 39%. Well, I must say, I really found that quite startling that only 4 out of 10 Americans have strong trust in the medical and scientific communities. I can understand how the trust is quite low in politicians and religious leaders, but only 4 out of 10 readily trusting scientists and medical scientists truly stunned me. Now, the chart is more sophisticated than what I have described, showing various levels of trust in each field. However, this broad-based lack of implicit trust may help us understand President Trump's appeal to segments in the electorate. It also helped me to understand why science and religion are siblings. What was quite trustful at one time is less so today, and it affects both religion and science. Well, I can't imagine that in this community that level of distrust is understood, since many are part of a professional elite or have benefited from the elites in our lives. And if I had been part of the Pew poll, I would have checked the box of great confidence in scientific and medical communities. But apparently only 40% of the American populace felt that way. Why? Perhaps some of that distrust in middle America stems from the avalanche of prescriptions written by physicians for opiates and the resulting devastation of lives in already ransacked communities. Who protected those communities? Certainly not the medical doctors whose profit-making prescriptions flooded the market, nor the politicians who were running after other more glamorous issues and ignoring the pain and death in mid-America. The overdose death rate for rural areas due to opiates surpassed the death rate for urban areas. I think that the turning point, maybe for trust in science, took place when there were hearings before Congress on cigarettes. You had legitimate scientists working for the cigarette companies arguing that cigarettes' benign effects. And on the other side, legitimate scientists arguing that lung cancer and death were too often the result of smoking. But whatever the cause or causes for the decline in trust, like Humpty Dumpty, it has been a great fall for science. religion has its own problems with a drop in trust. Remember Jim and Tommy Baker and Jimmy Swaggart, among others? So science and religion have had a critically significant impact on medicine and education for the good. Science and religion have also had their own tragic episodes of mayhem and death. But there's also reason for their prominence, even in a time of lower trust. Well, there's one more thing, one final thing that religion and science have in common. They're both at heart rooted in wonder and awe. I remember once seeing a master wood carver tenderly trace the grain of a piece of wood he was working on, and then with obvious delight, raise the wood to his nose. He spoke about the wood's sensuality and its sweet aroma. Such wonder and delight, I am convinced, is the source of passion in any human endeavor, but especially in both the religious impulse and the scientific spirit. And this mutual passion can be seen in placing together statements of the biblical psalmist and Albert Einstein, and how much they match each other. Now, the psalmist lived at a time when the sky was clear and the myriad of stars filled the sky, not like Houston and Galveston. And the psalmist wrote, "The heavens declare the glory of God. The sky displays God's handiwork. Day after day it speaks out. Night after night it reveals God's greatness." Now, there's no actual speech or word, nor is there a voice literally heard. Yet its voice echoes throughout the earth. Its words carry to the distant horizon. And then Einstein, "The most beautiful emotion we can experience is the mysterious. It is the fundamental emotion that stands at the cradle of all true art and science. He to whom this emotion is a stranger, who can no longer wonder and stand rapt in awe, is as good as dead, a snuffed out candle. To sense that behind anything that can be experienced, there is something that our minds cannot grasp, whose beauty and sublimity reach us only indirectly. This is religiousness in this sense, and in this sense only, I'm a devoutly religious man." And of course, moving out of religion and science, it's the poets who speak well. Elizabeth Barrett Browning, who said, "Earth crammed with heaven, and every common bush afire with God. But only he who sees takes off his shoes. The rest sit around and pluck back blackberries." And D.H. Lawrence, who's better known for his novels than his poetry, had a line in one poem, "Oh, for the wonder that bubbles into my soul." It's that sense of wonder that is behind good religion and good science and good life. And it's at this point that religion and science certainly coexist within my mind and exist quite comfortably. It's not a war. It's a common passion to understand the world around. And religion and science have been so intermingled in American life throughout its history that they still kick each other under the table, but they don't create war against each other. Well, all of this brings to a conclusion what I have to say today, and now it's your turn to respond.